I've had the privilege and joy of knowing many Unitarian Universalists in many places. I've served many congregations. I've been a part of 11 different congregations throughout my life, UU congregation. When I was in Muncie, Indiana, I served in Muncie for 11 years, and it was great. I hope that the minister that you call, next minister you call, stays for 11 years. But I had been, when I got to Muncie, I immediately got involved. It was my second long-standing ministry, and I got very involved with the African-American community in Muncie, Indiana. I was very involved. And I had been there for 5 years before a young woman with children who is an African-American started to attend services. I had been standing up and speaking out and going to, especially doing some work in the community schools, and this woman had started coming to our worship. She had attended for about 3 months. She just continued to come for about 3 months when there was an elder in the congregation, an elder woman, who came up to her and said, "I'm so happy that you're here, and I'm so happy that you keep coming." And she goes, "But you must find our music terribly boring." And the woman looked at her, this young woman looked at this older woman, and she said, "I was raised Catholic. The music here is amazing." The problem was that this older woman had not taken any time to really get to know who this young woman was. Nothing about her story, nothing about what it is that she wanted or needed or was looking for, what it was that made her keep coming back for 3 months. She had not found out yet. She had not heard her story and let it in. She had not let that individual in. The stated vision of this congregation, our vision, we did some visioning work apparently before I was here, which people said, what will we look like at our best? What is the ideal of this congregation? And part of that stated vision is that we will be intentionally diverse, vibrant, and intentionally diverse. And so out of that, we have formed things like a racial justice task force, and we've engaged in beloved conversations about race in the midst of this congregation, and we are part of a larger UU community, the community of UU communities, which has stated that we are becoming anti-racist, anti-oppression, multicultural communities. But as Reverend Lovely wrote, to be what we say we want to be, we're going to have to think about power, not just kindness, not just friendliness. We have to think about how we share the abilities we have and who we share them with. Reverend Lovely said, power is too often thought of power over others when in a church, and I would add in a fellowship and in a religious community, the best use of power is used with others to achieve mutually desired goals. I decided to title this sermon, A Machiavellian View of Anti-Racism. By Machiavellian, I utterly reject the idea that the ends justify the means, though I know many people who seem to claim this and follow his advice in that matter. But what I'm certain, especially in a religious community, that the means are often the only experience we will ever have of the ends. By Machiavellian, I only mean to say that if we're going to change fit our spiritual vision, then we need to find the power to make that change because the resistance to change is great. The power for social change only comes from expanding who you know as an individual, understanding what it is that those people want, and claiming what you are willing to sacrifice to make it a reality. A simple little illustration of that is when my first daughter was born, I did not sleep a whole lot. I have photographs of me at 2 a.m. holding her. I was willing to sacrifice sleep. I had to figure out who she was and what she needed and what I was willing to give up in order to express love. It's about sharing my life, my power, and my ability to sleep with her. To confront racism, it is not enough to be good. It is not enough to be loving and to reach out and to avoid insulting or demeaning other people. You have to know who those people are. Oh, I forgot to turn off my cell phone. It was my daughter, too. She's, what's she calling me? Like, oh, right. She should know better. If you want to shift the way that power is distributed and keep your faith and move towards our vision, if you want to shift yourself, whether it's in this congregation or it's in this part of California or all you congregations or in the nation, you have to know who it is that you're trying to serve. You have to know those people as individuals so that you can understand who they are as a group. You must understand what it is that they want, and then you have to claim what you're willing to sacrifice to help them. Now, set this in some institutional and historical context. I'm not talking at all about the global situation. I know too much about this subject. I've been involved with anti-racism, anti-oppression work for a long time. So I know how this lives in Romania. Right? But I'm just going to talk about this country. In this country, several key central, significant, and radical abolitionists, people fighting against slavery, were Unitarian or they were Universalist, and they were sustained by their faith and their communities. But congregations, Unitarian and Universalist congregations, did really not much of anything about addressing the problems and the evils of chattel slavery in this country. Here's an interesting fact. The National Association for Colored People, the NAACP, was founded with a significant majority leadership from white Unitarians. And later, we were very involved in the civil rights struggle, and two of our people were killed in Selma. But most of us unconsciously have allowed the larger U.S. culture to segregate our congregations from people of color, from minority communities. And our ideals of inclusion have always crashed into social realities. One of the most disastrous was at our 1968 UU General Assembly, in which we started talking about power and money and found that we were having trouble talking about that in terms of race. You should know also that Whitney Young was a powerful leader of the National Urban League, transformed the Urban League in the 20th century. And along with his wife, Margaret, he and Margaret were the first two blacks to join the Unitarian Universalist Church of Atlanta, Georgia. Due in part to the Young's influence in the 1950s, that church stopped having its annual picnics at segregated parks. I never really thought about the consequences of that before. And they chose to become integrated, not just desegregated. And yet, UU congregations have always been overwhelmingly white, Eurocentric communities. At the end of the 1980s, we restarted our commitment to fighting racism in our ranks and beyond. In 2001, we elected the association's first black president, and then our first Hispanic president in 2009. But in 2017, that very president, Jose Morales, resigned under new controversies about the shortcomings of our approach to fighting racial inequities amongst our ranks and outside. Always there have been people of African heritage or Asian heritage in Unitarian Universalist congregations. There have been islanders and mestizos and people of other ethnicities in Unitarian and Universalist congregations. They have been leaders. We have had leaders. Our leaders have been of minority and have been people of color, but always the leaders who are of people of color were small in number and even smaller in percentage. It's in that context that I talk about how to become multicultural. When I started my first ministry in Lubbock, Texas, several years ago, one of the first things I did was ask about liberal black churches. And then I went to a Church of God in Christ. Anyone here know about the Church of God in Christ? Kogik? I met some people, that's good. I went over to the Church of God in Christ and I met the minister, young guy. And I told him about my inspiration in knowing about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I talked about Mahatma Gandhi, and I talked about changing the world. And I said I was willing to do whatever he wanted to ally with him. And his response was to start asking me questions. He asked me questions like, where were you born, and where's your family? Who's your family? And where are you from? How long have you been living in Lubbock? He was asking me these questions. And it wasn't until like a year or two later that I realized I didn't ask him any of those questions. Because then what he did was, after he was asking me about myself, he asked me, and so who do you know in my congregation? And I said, I don't know anyone in your congregation. I just moved to the city. He said, well then, so who do you know in the neighborhood of my congregation? And I said, I don't know anybody in the neighborhood of your congregation. And then he said, you can't help people you don't know. You don't know who they are. You don't know what they need. And whatever you think they need, you'll be wrong. He said, get to know the people. And then maybe we can do something together. Eventually, I was involved with the organizing group in Lubbock, Texas. And I remember meeting some elder Hispanic women, these two Hispanic women. And they told me how odd it was to sit at a table with a white guy in a tie. How frightening that had been, because that always meant death or danger or disaster in the earlier history. And getting to know them changed who my understanding of who it was I was working with, who it was I was working for, and what it is that they needed. I volunteered in a reading program there in a majority black school where I was the minority. And I got to know those boys. Some of them had dads in jail, and some of them had dads who were hardworking and loving in their lives. And I was helping them read, getting to know who they were and what their lives were about. It took me a long time to get involved with the black clergy group there, get involved in events that on the black side of town, work with the Hispanic people, and to start to learn who the Hispanic people. So then only then did I know what I was talking about when I was trying to speak truth to power. Later, I was in Muncie, Indiana. I had been involved in 9 years at one point, of continuous visible work with the black leaders. It was really hard for me to get into the black clergy group. The first three times that I tried to go to their meetings, it turned out that they had had that meeting in that church the month before, but that month they were somewhere else and I couldn't find them. Took me a long time to get in. Took me years. But I knew something had changed when the editor of the black paper, a woman named B. Foster, we'd had conversations. She had read me the Riot Act a couple of times. She had told me, given me marching orders a number of times, and I had listened with respect. And so finally, I knew something had changed when she called me up and she asked me for some advice about how to cook with tofu. I was the only vegetarian that she knew that she could also trust enough to ask these questions. It was a radically multicultural moment. It's essential to step across the boundaries that divide us and get to know who we are. Her doctor had put her on a no-meat diet. And I understood the things she was struggling with. I understood the physical pain that she was living with and trying to address, so that when she asked me about tofu, it was just not about eating stuff. It was about healing power. There was a congregation. There are several more diverse congregations. Some of them have long history in Chicago and Philadelphia, Maryland, near Washington D.C. and Unitarian Universalist circles that have been a little bit more successful in bringing in people of diversity. But the most successful right now is in Tulsa, Oklahoma. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, there was a small little black universalist congregation. It was a leftover. The whole story about how they got kicked out of the Oral Roberts universe from a mega church, the last little remainder, but it was 230 people, so about the same membership size as this congregation. And they came eventually to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and said, we'd like to join you. Well, you'd like to have 230 members just kind of walk in and say, hey, we're going to join your church. It was, I know Reverend Marlon Lavinar is still there. It was a difficult, painful journey. Because first, they had to know who these people were. They had to get to know them as individuals, not just as part of some group, to integrate them, to make them a part of the community. And then they had to figure out what they wanted. And it was hard. They had conflicts over worship right away. What kind of music are you going to have? How often are you going to have that music? What kind of words are you going to use? What kind of language are you going to use? And then they found those little things like, how do you run a potluck supper? And what do you bring? And how do you arrange it? And who's in charge? They had things like, they would have someone on a committee meeting, and all the people who they had very intentionally included from the black part of their community did not show up on time to that meeting. And suddenly there were tensions about how do you know when things begin and when they don't begin, and how do you decide when things begin? People from the Universalist Church or the kind of black Universalists from the black culture said, the meeting starts when we all get here. And the other people were saying, that's not how we run things. And I said, but we're a part of you now. We're a part of you now. We are in this together. What are our new rules? They had to struggle to figure out what they wanted, who they were. They had to understand each other as individuals. When I was in Muncie, Indiana, the black community demanded that a street be changed to the name of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. And they immediately got pushback. And I went to the Black Clergy Caucus, and I asked all those men, I said, well, and one woman, there's one woman in the Black Clergy Caucus, and I said, what is it that you want? And they said, well, what we want are better opportunities, more opportunities, and better jobs for the people in our congregations. But we know that if they're not going to give us the power to rename a street, there's no way they're going to give us the power to access jobs, to improve our economy, and to improve our lives. So we want the name of the street changed. And so, despite whatever other ideas I might have had about how to honor Martin Luther King Jr., or what street it should have been, the name should have been, I stood with them, I gave my voice, and joined my voice with theirs. I listened to what they wanted. Because I knew that what they wanted was not simply the name of a street. I knew what they wanted was dignity. I knew what they wanted was safety. I had listened carefully enough to know that when they said change the name of a street, they were saying a whole lot more. So once you know some people and you've claimed those people as your friends and allies and they're willing to trust you, you've been able to listen to them long enough in order to connect with them, then only you can ask yourself, what are you willing to sacrifice? What are you willing to spend in order to help them? When you know who you love and serve and you know what they want, then you have to ask. When I was in St. Louis, city of St. Louis, I was on the streets of Ferguson. I knew what those people wanted. I knew why they were standing in the streets. The fear that they lived with, the violence they lived with, the harassment, all that came into standing in those streets in Ferguson. And the police lining up, sort of confront us, county police. Now the county had gone to the Army surplus store and had bought a van. It was an armored van and it had a machine gun mounted on the top. As if my own government was reminding me of what I would have to risk if I was going to push it too hard. My friends had told me about this, but I was shocked when I finally saw it. I was there late enough in the day when all of a sudden there was a person in that van. The person was not holding on to the machine gun, but they were sitting right next to it, ready to hold it at any moment. And I knew that the color of my skin, the fact that I was wearing a suit and tie, was not going to make any difference if they decided that it was needed to be used. And I had to think for a moment. Not very long, because I already knew how much was at stake. I knew the lives of people were at stake. And so I was willing to join with them. And we had 358 continuous days of protest. And only 2 days of some violence against property. And yet, we had to think about how important it was to stand against violence, to stand against oppression, to stand against segregation and isolation and division of our community. That's what we were standing against. You will not need to sacrifice your life to fight racism and its attendant oppressions in this nation. But will you take the time, will you give the time, will you sacrifice the time to know Spanish-speaking children and the struggles they have to learn and thrive in this country? You've given of your money to support Casa Cornelia, and some of us are giving time and energy, volunteer time and energy to support Casa Cornelia because we understand that we do not want race and situation and nation to divide us from other human beings. We want to open our heart and connect to those people and know them. But think about this. We also have Casas de Luz. It's an organization. It's actually a ministry, technically a ministry of this congregation. But how many people that we have built houses for do you know personally? Have you met the people for whom we're building houses? Have you met the people who are organizing and leading in Mexico, the people from Juarez, Mexican citizens who are our partners? Do you know the names of any of our partners? Have you taken time to get to know who those people are? Reach out to them. Anybody on the other side of the dividing lines, on the other side of the barriers, on the other side of the walls that this nation keeps trying to create, only then, if we step across the borders and get to know people, and know who they are, and know what they want, will we be able to undo the evil in this world? When will the world become more one? When will we truly become multicultural? Maybe. Maybe that day is today. Maybe that day is tomorrow. It depends on who you know, and who you serve, and how well you are willing to serve them.